I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books on money and finance at the center of many a fine plot. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And bestselling author Jacqueline Michard. Good morning.
Hi.
Great to have you here. So you had a lot of fun with this, Jill.
Well, there are so many directions you can go with this topic. And it was such a pleasure to revisit so many 19th century novels that I love to read so much. And in fact, my reading list now is probably, you know, six times higher than it was before I started looking for books about money, just because I remembered all these great novels we might read in the future, reread.
Was it a fun assignment for you, Jackie?
I loved it. I loved it. Money is a big thing in my life, the having of it, the not having of it. And I had to narrow my list down. I started with 50 books or something like that. And I tried to narrow them down by books that were also well-written.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know.
Right. It's always you might want to actually read, right?
Right.
All right. What's your first book, Jill?
Well, I'm starting with a Lydia Davis story. And Lydia Davis writes very, very, very short stories, as it happens. She has her collected stories of Lydia Davis, which include a surprising number, actually, of stories about money. And I'm going to start with reading one story, which is, as I say, surprisingly short, and it is called Money. I don't want any more gifts, cards, phone calls, prizes, clothes, friends, letters, books, souvenirs, pets, magazines, land, machines, houses, entertainments, honors, good news, dinners, jewels, vacations, flowers, or telegrams. I just want money. And
that
is the whole sentence, the whole story. And it's great. You know, she knows a woman who knows what she wants. And as I say, there are many great little stories about money in here. One is all about what a 60 cents coffee actually buys you, and that you get not just the, if you're in a diner. First of all, I don't know what year she wrote this, that she got a 60 cent. She's talking about a Brooklyn coffee shop. I'm shocked to see that there was ever a 60 cent coffee. But in any case, she talks about, you know, you get one metal cream picture, one plastic glass, one small table, two small benches. Besides the coffee and the cream, you have water with ice cubes and in their own dispenser, sugar, salt, pepper, napkins, and ketchup. She sort of monetizes all the things you get with your one cup of coffee. And she has another great story called Finances, which is all about the equality or inequality of what men bring to a marriage and what women bring to a marriage. If you've never read a Lydia Davis story, they're great fun, and particularly her money stories are very short and interesting.
I like that there's some short ones in there. I don't have as much time as I used to, so that might be a
good book for me. Yeah, Lydia Davis is perfect size for the amount of time our brains have right now to actually pick up a book and read
something. Okay. Jackie, what's your first book?
Well, this one is not short. It's The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, which I just loved. It was a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, but really very long, more than 800 pages. It starts about a painting. It's about a painting that during an explosion, a mishap, is liberated from a museum, and then the way that painting influences the lives of so many people who are a part of that mishap. It's a wonderful story, and it's gorgeously written. And I really love long books. I love when I commit to a story, I want that story to take up a couple of weeks. And if it could take up a season, I would like that even more. I highly recommend it.
That is such a fabulous novel. And I actually was lucky enough that I was on vacation when I was reading that, so that I didn't get interrupted. I could just keep reading and reading, because you don't want it to stop. You're just like, what's going to happen next? And it is very much about money and the worth of things and how much a painting is worth, if it's on the wall, if it's not on the wall. Really, really interesting. Great, great novel. And maybe she could have used a better editor, I think. I don't know. 50 pages, maybe she could have.
No, I know her editor.
She wasn't the editor
for a while. I just think that she is a writer who writes every one of her novels is really long. But I don't think there's too much fat in them. I think there's just gorgeous expansiveness.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, and when you have a good book like that, you don't want it to end. Mm-hmm. You know, how many times have you had a book, you end the story and you're like, oh, I don't want it to end. I want to keep going. So, so something to be said, and it's something to be said for somebody who can write a book that's 800 pages or what, and then you still want more.
Right, because we don't do that anymore.
No, it's hard
now
to do.
When people look at a story and it's 240 pages, people say, I don't know. I'm very busy. Well, listen, you know, you're not as busy as I am. I have 4 jobs. I have 9 kids. You're not as busy as I am. So commit.
All right, there you go.
Or read Lydia Davis.
You know,
read
Lydia Davis.
Read something.
Right. What's your next book?
Well, when I knew we were going to do this show, the first book I actually thought about was the one I have in my hand, which is Shapinsky's Karma, Boggs Bills, and Other True Life Tales by Lawrence Weschler. This book came out quite a while ago. I was excited that the library actually still had a copy, and it came out in 1988. Lawrence Weschler wrote for The New Yorker, and this particular article had really stuck with me, the one about Boggs Bills. And Boggs Bills is about J.S.G. Boggs, who is an artist who draws money. But he doesn't draw so much to make counterfeit bills. He draws it because he wants to experience the transaction of trying to pay for something. He'll go into a coffee shop, he'll go into a store with his art. That is a bill, but not a real bill. And part of what he does is, as the whole transaction, is he not only gets them to, you know, take the bill, he then sort of takes pictures of everything that he's bought with the bill. And so when his art is hung, it's not just about the bill, it's about the whole transaction around money. So he's really looking at that intersection between art and money. And this essay is really fascinating. And here's a little bit about what he's looking for when he's looking at a bill. He writes, and let me just get to my page here. There it is. I mean, look at this thing. No one ever stops to look at the bills in their pocket, just stops and admires the detailing, the conception, the technique. Part of my work is intended to get people to look at such things. Take this one here. This is an absolutely splendid intaglio print. It's actually the result of 3 separate printing processes, 2 on the face side, another on the back, all done on excellent high-quality paper. Over the years, because of the danger of counterfeiting, they've had to make these bills more and more intricate, both in terms of imagery and technique. And he goes on to talk about this act of faith that takes place when he brings one of his bills. Now, needless to say, not everybody thinks it's art. Many people think it's, in fact, counterfeiting. And he ended up in court in England because he was doing this in England as well as America. And there's also this whole section in this essay about how when he tries to do this in America, it's much harder to pass the bills than it was when he was in England, because people are like, no, you know, maybe my manager can do this, but I can't take this bill for whatever it is he was trying to pay for. So it's a really beautiful and interesting article about art and money and the intersection of the two. And apparently he is still doing this. I mean, he's still, except now he's doing it more electronically than he is the actual artwork. Or he's creating artwork on the computer rather than by hand, which is what he had been doing. And there, in fact, was, which I didn't know, a whole book by Weschler on Boggs called Boggs, A Comedy of Values. So if you enjoy Shapinsky's Karma, Boggs Bills, you can move on to Boggs, A Comedy of Values.
All right. Jackie.
Well, this book is a bestseller right now. This is a nonfiction book called Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and a Culture in Crisis by J.D. Vance. This was a book that I wasn't sure that I was going to really love, because it's written by a guy who's politically very conservative and defensive about his upbringing. And I absolutely loved reading it. It's about the poorest white people. It's about people who would customarily be referred to as hillbillies or as white trash. And that is his family context. He comes from the sort of little corner of Ohio and Kentucky, and talks about the terrible difficulty of growing up in a culture in which parents basically abrogated and the grandparents raised the children, and the education was by far not a value. It was talked about, but most people were finished with school when they were sophomores in high school. And it was a very moving story. It's a very moving book. And I think particularly significant right now in our society, given that when we just had an election. Did you hear? that in which people talk about the sort of rage of the white underclass and the pain of lost jobs and lost dreams and so forth. And that's really dealt with in this story.
Yeah, somebody was just telling me about that book the other day, also recommending it.
Yeah.
And there's still a huge waiting list at the library for that book. That has been enormously popular.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jill.
Well, I thought we should think a little bit about the history of money. And because we're here on Cape Cod, I brought along Wampum and the Origins of American Money, written, funnily enough, by a guy named Mark Shell. I don't know if it seems it was his destiny to write about Wampum. And it's a really what is interesting about this book is that it is a really academic book. This is not sort of an easy, fun read, but you learn so much that I certainly didn't know. It was published by the University of Illinois Press. So it's an academic book. But for an academic book, it is really beautiful. There are gorgeous photos of wampum and the quahog shell for making wampum. And it turns out that it was used as currency. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, a certain group of people. Everybody was using this. And the definition in English, the English term wampum, means those generally tubular beads made from clam or conch shell. Europeans often use these shells for what they call mercenary transactions. And it talks about Harvard having this enormous collection, which I had, you know, no idea. It says a proper Yankee professor should complain about this reduplication. After all, Harvard, with its famed Indian college, reliably teaches hardly a single native North American language. Ironically, Harvard's huge treasure house still holds vast quantities of wampum, or its equivalent, from when wampum was legal tender in Massachusetts, a time when writers such as Thomas Letchford and his Plain Dealing, 1641, complained that Puritan co-religionists were contributing imperfect wampum at the church collection.
Wow.
So, I mean, this is being given as absolute, you know, the sort of the Bitcoin of its time, right? And in 17th century Massachusetts, this was considered perfectly good money.
Wow.
And so, which I, you know, didn't actually know that. And it focuses really on the colonial era and the American Revolution, and talks about paper currency as paper wampum, that, you know, paper wampum and paper currency were one and the same. And the final portion of it is the history of the development of the U.S. economy to the present day, that sort of contextualizes wampum as the origin of the American economic system. Hmm. So a really fascinating sort of a local history story. Not sort of, it is a local history story called Wampum and the Origins of American Money by Mark Shell.
That's an easy one to remember, Mark Shell. We're talking about books on money and finance. If you have a suggestion to add to our list, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Books on Money and Finance today with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Jacqueline Michard. 866-999-4626 is our number if you would like to recommend a book on money and finance. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Jackie, what's your next book?
My next book is the novel Commonwealth by Ann Patchett, which was published last year and which I just love. I love every book Ann Patchett has ever written and would follow her anywhere. But this, and it's not strictly about money or bills. It's about the disunion, the union and disunion of families from disparate backgrounds, from backgrounds of wealth and backgrounds of working class sensibilities and how that works out or doesn't work out. And it also is one of those stories that has, it's a novel within a novel, because it's the story about a famous writer who's on the skids and married to a much younger, poorer woman, writing a novel that is called Commonwealth, that essentially rips off the story of her family and how that works out, which you can imagine is not like a beach picnic. It's a terrific story, and like everything Anne writes, it's tremendously well written and lyrical. And also, just there are some great writers who write beautiful stories sentence by sentence, you know? And there are some great writers who do that, but also have a story that is just meaty, and that it's sort of like a chicken pot pie of all kinds of good things inside of it. And that's how she writes, is just, it's a whole meal of a novel.
Yeah. Commonwealth, Ann Patchett. Okay. And I should mention, we'll have a link to the list of books we talk about up on our website later today. We have to put it together after the show. Jill does
that. We will. I love that. A whole meal of a novel.
I know.
That's like the best novels. That's what they are, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put
terrific.
It.
That's terrific. Yeah. I brought along a book by Margaret Atwood called Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth. Speaking of writers who, boy, has she written a lot. And I think this is actually was based on a series of essays that originated as lectures on Canadian radio. The Canadians seem to do a lot of radio lectures. I had some other book recently that was all Canadian lectures. And I love the Publisher's Weekly Review, which starts, Atwood's book is weird, but wonderful melange of personal reminiscences, literary walkabout, moral preachment, timely political argument, economic history, and theological query, all bound together with wry wit and careful, though casual seeming research, which, you know, pretty much describes it. And somehow they made a documentary film out of this in 2012, which I'm going to watch because I can't figure out how they would have done that. But she talks about why she was trying to write this book right at the beginning. And she says, the motive for this book is curiosity, mine. And my hope is that the writing of it will allow me to explore a subject I know little about, but which for this reason intrigues me. That subject is debt. Payback is not about debt management or sleep debt or the national debt or about managing your monthly budget or about how debt is actually a good thing because you can borrow money and then make it grow or about shopaholics and how to figure out that you are one. Bookstores and the internet abound in such materials. Nor is it about more lurid forms of debt, gambling debts and mafia revenges, karmic justice whereby bad deeds trigger reincarnation as a beetle or melodramas in which mustache twirling creditors use non-payment of the rent to force unwanted sex on beautiful women, though it may touch on these. Instead, it's about debt as a human construct, thus an imaginative construct, and how this construct mirrors and magnifies both voracious human desire and ferocious human fear. And there's a great chapter in here which will lead you to all kinds of great novels called Debt as Plot, which begins, without memory, there is no debt. Put another way, without story, there is no debt. And she goes on to talk about all these wonderful novels. And then she ends up with this very strange sort of chapter on Christmas Carol, a retelling of Christmas Carol, and sort of a riff on Dickens. So very interesting book, really interesting read. It's called Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth by Margaret Atwood.
Hi, Jackie.
Well, my next book is also a novel. Recent novel. It's called Sons and Daughters of Ease and Privilege by Ramona Ossebel, who is best known as a short story writer. And this is a terrific novel about a family of hereditarily wealthy young people, a married couple, both of whom come from privilege, one tragic privilege, one just sort of ordinary privilege. But who never have to think about money until everything falls apart. And it falls apart when they're on their wonderful vacation in this wonderful, on a little island off of Cape Cod. And when their life falls apart and they realize that there will be no more vacations and endless summers with bathing suits and sweet corn and their beautiful blonde children, and that they're going to have to do something that they never imagined, work. And you would think that these would be absolutely horrible people with whom you could not identify in any way, but it is the skill of the writer that you do feel both sympathy and empathy for these people who have never learned to be useful.
And the title of the book and the author again?
Sons and Daughters of Ease and Privilege by Ramona Ossabel.
Thank you. Jill.
Well, this I have good segue for that one, which is I've brought along Madame Bovary, also sort of unpleasant people who don't know what to do with their lack of money. And there is a great intro to this book in the Margaret Atwood book that I was just mentioned. And she, in her chapter on debt as plot, she talks about Madame Bovary and she says, "Or shall we turn to debt as it impacts on women? We might start by investigating Flaubert's 1857 novel, Madame Bovary, the story of a provincial wife who takes to romantic love, extramarital sex, and overspending as an escape from boredom, but then poisons herself when her double life catches up with her and her unpaid creditor threatens to expose her. This book was put on trial for obscenity, and Flaubert defended it by brandishing Emma's hideous-looking corpse as an example of the book's inherent morality. The wages of sexual sin is arsenic, and not only does it kill you, it wrecks your looks, but that's a red herring. Emma isn't really punished for sex, but for shopaholicism. Had she but learned double-entry bookkeeping and drawn up a budget, she could easily have gone on with her hobby of adultery forever, or at least until she got saggy, though she'd have done it in a more frugal manner," which is hilarious because, of course, you know, that's right, yes? That she is, her money problems are what really do her in. Yeah. And it is the descriptions of her interactions with these people who are trying to collect her bills are really something. Here's a section right from Madame Bovary. Again, Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert. And this is, in fact, a translation by Lydia Davis, who not only writes very short stories, but also translates from the French. And here's a little bit of it. "To make some money for herself, she began selling her old gloves, her old hats, the old scrap iron, and she haggled rapaciously, her peasant blood driving her to make a profit. Then, on her trips to the city, she would trade with secondhand dealers for knickknacks that Monsieur Leroux, if no one else, would certainly buy from her. She bought herself ostrich feathers, Chinese porcelain, and round-topped chests. She borrowed from Felicity, from Madame LeFrancoise, from the landlady of the Croix Rouge, from anyone, anywhere. Out of the money she received at last from Barneville, she paid two notes. The remaining 1,500 francs melted away. She signed new notes, and so it went on. Sometimes, it is true, she would attempt some calculations, but she would discover things so exorbitant that she could not believe them. So she would begin again, quickly become muddled, drop it all at that point, and think no more about it." And the whole sort of last third of the book is about her money problems, mm-hmm. which are what, in fact, end up doing her in and why she ends up, you know, taking the arsenic.
And my next novel is about the same thing.
Ah.
It's Anna Karenina, which is right. about gambling instead of
yes.
shopping, and was inspired by Leo Tolstoy seeing the not good body of his neighbor's sweetheart, mistress, if you will, after she'd been hit by a train because, you know, things got out of hand. And also, I love this book. I've always loved this book and read it many times, but I also love it because it was inspired. It inspired one of the best quotes from one of my parents that I ever heard in my life. Now, my parents did not finish high school. I'm the first person in my family ever to have finished high school. But my mom was a fierce reader. And she had a sort of a little book club with the guy across the alley who had only gone to the sixth grade.
Wow.
And my mom one day was saying to Willie, "Did you get to the part in the train station?" And it was years before I realized that my mom was talking about Anna Karenina, which they had both read. And my mom said after that, her next the next thing she said was, you know, that is a book that takes all the fun out of adultery. I'll remember that all my life.
and Madame Bovary as well. Yeah. Lessons are learned,
lessons
right?
Lessons learned, that's
wow.
Right.
Wow, oh, that's great. That's so great.
Fritz is giving us a call from Katuit. Good morning, Fritz.
Hello.
Hi, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
I would like to recommend a book called Father Struck It Rich.
Father Struck
It's
It
Rich. Not a recent book, but it was by Evelyn Walsh McLean. And it's about a woman whose father struck it rich in a gold mine in Colorado. And she goes on to, he buys enough property in Washington, D.C. to have a nine-hole golf course and entertain presidents. I think it was Cleveland. She's rich enough to buy a Mercedes touring car every time she goes to Europe. And on a whim, she bought the Hope Diamond.
Oh, my.
Wow.
It is just a bizarre story.
And that's Father Struck It Rich by Evelyn Walsh McLean. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yes. Thanks for that, Fritz. We appreciate that. We'll put that on our list. Thanks for the call.
All right.
866-999-4626 if you have a book you'd like to recommend for us. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill.
Well, and to continue with the gambling theme, I have brought with me Daniel Deronda by George Eliot, which in fact begins in a gambling establishment, and our heroine is gambling. And I love the description of this novel, which is this is from one of my favorite reference books, which is called Binet's Reader's Encyclopedia, and it gives these great simple plot descriptions for very complicated novels. And in this case, it begins, the last novel of George Eliot, the heroine, Gwendolyn Harleth, marries Henley Grandcourt in order to avoid impending destitution of herself and her mother. This she does in spite of a promise made to the mother of his illegitimate children.
There
which,
you go.
You know, what more do you need for a novel, right? And it begins, as I say, at the gambling table. And here's the first paragraph, which is just beautiful. And talking about her, and it is our hero who will become our hero, Daniel Deronda, looking at Gwendolyn at the gambling table. And it says, was she beautiful or not beautiful? And what was the secret of form or expression which gave the dynamic quality to her glance? Was the good or the evil genius dominant in those beams? Probably the evil. Else why was the effect that of unrest rather than of undisturbed charm? Why was the wish to look again felt as coercion and not as a longing in which the whole being consents? She who raised these questions in Daniel Deronda's mind was occupied in gambling. And it goes on to talk about her needing to, she gets a telegram, a letter from her mother saying that she has to come home right away. They've got run out of money. You know, the debts need to be paid. You know, come home from the gambling table. And she ends up going to pawn the necklace she has on. And once she has pawned the necklace, then Daniel Deronda comes to the rescue because he sees that she has done this and gives her back the necklace. And that is the beginning of the whole ball game here. Was she's lost her money and he rescues her at this moment. And it has this great long sort of 19th century description of everybody at the gambling table at the beginning. Just here's a little taste of it. About this table, 50 or 60 persons were assembled, many in the outer rows where there was occasionally a deposit of newcomers being mere spectators, only that one of them, usually a woman, might now and then be observed putting down a 5-franc piece with a simpering air just to see what the passion of gambling really was. So a very interesting novel about money, gambling, and marrying the wrong man is also involved.
Right, Ebba's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Ebba.
Good morning.
Good morning. You have a
hi.
Yeah, hi. What's your?
I'd like to recommend one of my favorite classic mystery series, The Travis McGee series by John D. McDonald. The protagonist here, Travis McGee, is not a conventional detective. He's a salvage consultant who helps people get back things of value that have been lost or stolen. And his sidekick, his helper, is Meyer, who's a eminent economist of national repute. And many of the plots contain fairly intricate financial dealings that Meyer helps unravel. And in the days before the Internet, the series began in the 60s, they often solve mysteries by following financial paper trails.
Mm.
They're a lot of fun, and you can still get them at your library.
All right. Jill.
Thanks for the plug for libraries.
You've got it at the library. And that's by, you said John McDonald?
John D. McDonald.
John D.
Travis McGee series.
Travis
McGee. It began with, oh gosh, I think it was the Deep Blue Goodbye. Or
we can get to the bottom of that.
Color in them.
Yeah, we can find out the titles. Thanks so much, Abba, for that suggestion. We appreciate that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More books with a money theme right after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about books on money and finance with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Jacqueline Machard. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We got a suggestion from Jenny. She suggests The House of Mirth, 1905, by Edith Wharton. You have that on your list?
Yes, I do.
I'll let you talk about it then.
Well, The House of Mirth is, again, a story. These are all very, you know, about women's downfalls. And this is, and I don't know how I feel about that, but what a wonderful, full-hearted, upsetting novel mm-hmm. by Edith Wharton, who knew how to do that and also wrote great ghost stories. If you ever want to check that out, she wrote ghost stories that were so scary that I had to leave the light on in the room after I finished reading them. Have you ever read them?
No, I've never read her ghost stories. Wow.
Holy cow. No prisoners.
Oh, see, wow. I thought Stephen King was, but I had to leave the light on.
These are scary. These are sere and elegant and really frightening.
Wow.
Okay. But The House of Mirth, about the young woman, the protagonist, chooses joy and fur bellows and mirth over common sense, and like all these women, like Sister Carrie, like all these people who had the temerity to have a good time, she's struck down. Mm-hmm. And it was also made into a really wonderful movie. Have you seen
the I did
movie
see
with
that.
Gillian Anderson?
Yes, yes.
Just a tremendous film. And again, a moral tale about frittering away your money and being the kind of person who dances in the sunshine instead of putting away your coins, especially if you have the misfortune to have been born a woman.
Mm. Right. And there must be novels with men who also lose their fortunes, but the 19th
Jude
century...
Jude the Obscure
really,
is one of them that I have written down.
All
and
right.
It's about a man who... He was supposed to be terrific. He was going to be a contender, and instead he turned out to be a bum. So Jude the Obscure was one of the ones that I by Thomas Hardy, I wrote down as one that was about a guy.
Dennis is giving us a call from Provincetown. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning. A great show, just a great show. And I reflected that... almost every book is about money, if you think about it. But I'm going to embarrass myself because I let the dog out. I missed part of the show. But have you brought up Dickens yet?
No,
only...
Certainly every one of his books is about money. I'm thinking especially of Bleak House.
Absolutely.
Wonderful, funny book, despite the title, that has money at its core. But all of his books, really.
Right. Yeah, Jackie's saying all of them. And you have...
I have great expectations.
So that was one of the...
Yes.
You should never expect too much.
You may hear about the goldfinch in the show, about Bird Book, mm-hmm. Mindy.
Okay. In other words, you're going to recommend it again.
Absolutely. It's a great bird book.
All right, Dan.
Anyhow, thank you for a great show.
Sure, Dennis, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dennis sort of let the cat out of the bag.
I guess
next,
so.
Next month's show is about books on birds.
I didn't realize that was
birds.
That, Dennis, until you mentioned the birds, yes.
Right. Jill, what's your next book?
Today, as it happens, is Virginia Woolf's birthday. So I, having been a big fan of Virginia Woolf and a big fan of women's diaries, have brought along one of her diaries. And this one is happens to be volume 3, 1925 to 1930. And if you want to read about women's relationship with money, a good place to do it is in their diaries. Because when things are going bad, when things are going well, they will write things about this. And here's just a brief little bit of Virginia Woolf's diary in celebration of her birthday today. She writes, this is Sunday, 20 November. November 1927. Vita comes, Dottie comes, Clive incessant, Tom, Roger, we have our Bloomsbury evenings. For the first time, I have been spending money on a bed, on a coat. The coat, at the moment, I regret, and had a delicious sense of affluence the other day when at Longbarn I tipped Loon, the butler, for a night's lodging. But the money psychology is old, and that it doesn't give me enormous pleasure to spend. I doubt that I want anything enough, yet worry about spending wrongly, and must buy an evening dress, which worries me too. I've refused Sybil, accepted Ethel. Fame increases, I think. Young men write about me in their absurd random books. Domestic life, Nellie, that is, good as gold. Mm. During the war years, they have no money. So there are all these entries about how hard it is to be living without money and what they're going to do and how they will get food. And anyway, women's diaries in general, great place to read about money. This one is the diary of Virginia Woolf.
All right. Sam is giving us a call from Chilmark. Good morning, Sam.
Hi, good morning. It's good to speak with you.
You too.
I just wanted to recommend specifically a book that I picked up off of Kindle for 99 cents years ago called Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. and the author is Edwin Lefevre. It's really about Jesse Livermore, who was a terrific bear operator back in the 1920s. But a fascinating, easily read text, and as I said, only 99 cents.
and who was the author?
First name Edwin, E-D-W-I-N. Last name Lefevre, L-E-F-E, with an accent, V as in Victor, R-E, Reminiscences of a Stock Operator.
Wonderful. Sam, thanks for that suggestion. See the deals you can get, you know, think about it. There's, you know, the book sales. I mean, who knew 99 cents on Kindle? I didn't even know that you could buy a book for 99 cents.
Or free from your library.
Free from that's right. Get it in the library. Because what are you going to do with all those?
Well,
books?
Yeah, one of the great ways to save money, go to your public library.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, too. All of my favorite books, I don't have them anymore. Because what happens, you read a great book, and then you have to pass it on. You have to go, you got to read this book. And, of course, it never comes back to you. Hopefully, it keeps, you know, making the rounds to friends of friends of friends. But, right. Jackie, what's your next book?
My next book is a how-to book, which I don't hold with, and I don't hold with this book either, to tell you the truth, though it's very well written, called Minimalism, How to Declutter, De-Stress, and Simplify Your Life with Simple Living. One of the things I don't like about it is that simple repetition in there, by Simeon Lindstrom. It was recommended to me by a couple of people who I guess thought that I had more stuff than was needed to fill two suitcases. But I am not an advocate of simple living, you see. I am an advocate of complicated living, not of being a hoarder, but I like having my things around me. I have a simple house, and I don't have a bunch of stuff in it. I don't have a bunch of things in boxes, but I am offended in a sense by the attitude that we should all have only two pairs of black trousers and two black sweaters in our closets and one white shirt and one pair of shoes, because I believe that life is ornamental as well as practical. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really hold with minimalism. I think I hold with mediumism, with just moderationism, and that is what I would personally practice. However, this book is for people who really have become drifted under by clutter and the inability to relinquish things.
Mm-hmm. So how do you give it, how, you
how
get,
do you give
how
them
you
up? Give, yeah. How do you give them up, and how do you make those decisions when having things, not hoarding, but when having things has become emotional?
Well, and you know what the funny thing is, it's true, and I think this came from my grandmother, where I keep everything, and mm-hmm. and I've gotten to this point now where you just can't keep everything because you don't have a place to put it. But you know, you have, when we moved into our house and you have all these cupboards, I thought, well, I'll never fill all these cupboards. Well, guess what? All of those cupboards are full. And a real estate agent said when we bought the house, you know, that my daughter's bedroom, they said, you know, would we give her the smaller room, the bigger room? Whatever room you give a kid, they're going to fill it with stuff. You know, we just fill things up. So, yeah. So I might need that book. Right. I might need to get rid of some of that clutter. Jill?
I brought along a book that might help a few people. It's called Mind Over Money, The Psychology of Money and How to Use It Better by Claudia Hammond. And she is both, Claudia Hammond is a journalist, a writer, a psychology teacher. And as the Booklist Review said, in this witty, wise, well-researched look at humans' complicated relationship with money, she begins, the ills of our society are not caused by money itself, but the way we use it. Mm-hmm. So how can we all do a better job of using money for good rather than ill? Mm-hmm. And one of the things she has in the back, which I thought was the best thing about this book, and you know, we want to give you at least one, you know, money tip, since we're talking about money books. She has a whole section, chapter 15 is called Money Tips, and there are 263, a list of basically 263 experiments that she talks about in this book. And of those 263, she gives you 12 steps to do something better. So, for example, number one is always pay for snacks in cash if you're trying to eat healthily. Hmm. And this one, who knew? Number three, don't choose the same lottery numbers every week or you will never be able to stop playing. Because you'll always be afraid that your number's going to come up.
Oh, I get it. At first, I didn't get that.
And choose an expensive all-you-can-eat buffet rather than a cheap one if you want to enjoy the food more and not feel overly full. So you get all kinds of sort of practical advice in this book called Mind Over Money by Claudia Hammond.
Okay. Jackie?
I have to make a correction. Corrections Corner. I said Sons, Ramona Ossebal's book actually is called Sons and Daughters of Ease and Plenty. I put privilege down. I don't know why I did that. Mm-hmm. I knew that perfectly well. But it is Sons and Daughters of Ease and Plenty. And my next book also is a novel that is my favorite novel of all time.
Really?
Wow. Of all time, called A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith.
Yes.
And that contains the wonderful line, there is a tree that grows in Brooklyn. It would be considered beautiful, except that there are too many of it. And I love this book so much that I named my firstborn daughter Francie Nolan after the protagonist character in this book. It's a beautiful story of immigrant poverty and also of dignity, of the not making poor people seem as though they are somehow ennobled by their poverty, but an sort of instructive way in which people used creativity and care for each other and thoughtfulness in small and great ways to create lives that had some lyric passages in them in the context of living in tenements in Brooklyn. I love this story. I can't tell you how many times that I've read it, and I think that the mother in that story, Mary Nolan, taught me more than any of my female relatives ever taught me about being a mother. And being a home economist in some key ways, because she both knew how to be poor and how to be graceful.
Right, a tree grows in Brooklyn.
Well, and that's something that I remember reading in high school probably and loving, and I'm sure reading it again would be an amazing experience because it would be such a different mm-hmm. book. Right. As books change as you age,
right.
that would be one book that had really held up and has expanded in what it would mean.
It's held up wonderfully, and also people mistake it as being a young adult book because they read it like National Velvet. They read it when they're young.
Oh, yeah, right.
And it's just a beautiful, beautifully written book, and was so popular when it was published that the publisher had to borrow other people's printing presses make enough copies of it.
Wow.
Didn't know that. You know, you have to talk about this book.
Okay. Well, because, yeah, because we promised
in the promo.
Promise this in the promo. I know that Mindy likes to, you know, craft books once in a while. And here we have Origami with Dollar Bills, Another Way to Impress People with Your Money. And he followed this with Paper Airplanes with Dollar Bills. And let me tell you, if you have dollar bills to turn into origami, I'm really impressed. But nonetheless, his intro says, Origami with Dollar Bills offers a unique twist to traditional origami projects using a dollar bill instead of conventional origami paper. You don't have to look further than your wallet and beyond your hands in order to create 15 fabulous origami objects. And it is full of facts about dollar bills, and some of them actually require $3 bills.
Oh,
so the Oriental Dragon, for example, I mean, the first step is got like 21, there are 21 folds before you get, you know, to the second bill. So these aren't necessarily for children. These are really for people who are serious about their bills and their
crafting. Do you think the coffee shop's going to take my origami dragon if I try to pay for my
coffee
with that?
You know, that's a good question, but you do learn things in this book. For example, the lifespan of a bill depends on its denomination. A $1 bill lasts for approximately 22 months, tends to die young, while $50 and $100 bills have the longest existence with a survival rate of approximately 9 years. On average, a $20 bill will make it through one presidential term, 4 years, whereas 5 bills last half of that.
So that's because they're used more.
They're used more, absolutely.
Because you're sticking in the soda machines.
Although now I think this, you know, $20 bills seem to be getting used even more because the bank machines
are more expensive. Everything's more expensive.
So Origami with Dollar Bills, and then there's the follow-up, Paper Airplanes with Dollar Bills.
All right. Anything else on your list over there, Jackie?
I have a couple more. Negro Land, a memoir by Margot Jefferson about upper-class black families growing up in Chicago, the memoir of her own family, and The Swans of Fifth Avenue, a novel by Melanie Benjamin that was about Truman Capote and the rich women who were his sponsors and ultimately his destroyers. So
that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it was a good one.
All right. Oh, we're going to get Plotto in.
We're going to get Plotto in right at the end because this is the master book of all plots, Plotto by William Wallace Cook. And you cannot believe this is literally ways of describing books in order for authors to write, have more plots to write about. And you cannot believe how many of these plots have to do with finance. For example, A falls in love with B and renounces wealth, which he was to inherit by marrying BX. There's an explanation for who A is and who B is. Or A seeks to escape annoying manifestations of love. A, in order to escape annoying manifestations of love, pretends that a wax figure, X, is his invalid wife, pretends that he is married, pretends that he is engaged to be married. This is the sort of plot that is in here. And A, in love with B, is promised her hand in marriage if he will successfully accomplish a work of great difficulty, demonstrate his ability by securing a position at a salary which the parents of B think necessary.
All right, looking for some ideas for plots. There
great.
You go.
Go to Plotto.
Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and author Jacqueline Machado. Thank you both. Such fun to have you both here today.
Thank you
for being here. And again, we'll have the list, a link to the list of all the books we talked about up on our website, capeandislands.org, a little bit later this afternoon. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.